Yes, indeed. Fortunately for us, fascists tend to be incredibly stupid.
I was trying to stay neutral. Oops.
I don't know if you have to be particularly neutral in World War II. At least we won.
Oh, I have a good one for you. I have a good one for you.
Okay.
No, I'm serious. I'm serious about this. This has been puzzling me all my life, and I finally heard, I finally got the answer. We've all heard millions of questions. Why is Japan on the verge of surrendering, and we never should have dropped the atomic bomb? Should we have dropped 1, 2, 4, 0? I now have the answer. There is a book. Evan Thomas wrote a book, Past the Surrender, a couple years ago, where he goes into the details of both U.S. and Japanese governance. What happened at the end of World War II? And the short answer is, not only were we right to drop the atomic bomb, the fact that we dropped 2 of them worked out very, very well. What happened was, the Japanese military had a, most Japanese, the special military, had this attitude of, what's the word, basically, being defeated. The Japanese felt Japanese would not be defeated, and death was preferable to being defeated. And this was more pervasive than any American could ever understand. And they were practically on the verge of their own civil war when the Americans started bombing, eventually bombing all of the Japanese cities. And the same ones and the rabid lunatics were on the verge of civil war. And what happened was, after the first atomic bomb, a lot of those on the fence jumped over with the same ones. After 2, more jumped over. And that is when the Emperor Hirohito said, admitted, we lost, we're done.
On that as well. I don't think they could really explode any more bombs, but both of these bombs that were exploded were the experimental. One was a uranium-based and one was a plutonium-based. And the story I heard was that although it was a dramatic type of a thing, the first bomb, there was some noises in the background that we only had one of those. So I think they kind of, they used the second one, and they also kind of leaked information that they might have stockpiles of the damn thing so that, you know, the entire Japanese island chain would just go up in smoke. But, you know, it's, you know, Truman had that thing that said the buck stopped here. And, you know, it's a shame that those types of guys have faded into history.
The idea of the second one was spread with General Coolspot.
Okay, I mean, it worked out. That didn't work out for the poor guys who got radiation poisoning and died, but it did work out. Regularly the United States published the intelligence of how many American soldiers would have died in pitched battles of kind of taking over Japan. So it ultimately saved more lives than it took, if you believe in accountancy like that.
My father was one of them. I owe my existence to the atomic bomb.
Me also, same. Same here.
Okay. 2020 hindsight, but I agree with you guys again. I don't like anyone being killed, but unfortunately, some accountancy, and when you're in war, you're in war. So, and the Japanese took it very, very, very seriously. They were not funny guys. We kind of, most of us forget, Japan was a very strange country back in those days. very martial, very militaristic, borderline fascist. They weren't the guys that we buy transistor radios from these days.
Support.
Sure.
It's interesting these days we think about an argument, a war, SWR disagreement as being something that's won or lost by 51% margin. I don't think the Japanese and others that we were dealing with at the time saw anything like that. For them, a victory was of much more magnitude of percentage. 51% was not enough. That was not in any way seeked in their goals. And some others of the time, and some others of this time. We seem to think in a democratic process of 51% wins the game. A lot of times that's not the game today and in history. So there's that.
No, the bullet I mentioned was very, very specific. The Japanese were going to fight not for the last man, but the last person, including women and children. Their role was to have the Japanese population go to zero before they surrendered.
Yeah, I mean, they were the ultimate extremists. It's a monoculture. It's a mono race. There's very little genetic variation. They all kind of came to Japanese islands thousands of years ago from Korea, and except for the native population that's basically been stomped into the ground, it's all one single culture and one emperor, and they theoretically link their present emperor to his ancestor thousands of years ago. Very dubious of whether that's actually a legitimate thing or they tweak the histories or something. It's a different type of a culture, and it was a different culture back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. It was very military-based, and they had invaded China and done terrible things to the Chinese. To this day, mainland China loathes and despises the Japanese and regularly will show make-believe documentary films of Chinese people slaughtering the Japanese soldiers when they invaded China. So, again, history is fascinating, and I'm sad that a lot of people don't care and don't know. They're indifferent to it, unfortunately. It's not exactly that history repeats itself, but I believe, as the saying goes, history rhymes. So it doesn't exactly repeat, but it's like poetry. There are things that rhyme with 1930 today. Okay, it seems like I tired everyone out.
Just listening, Dr. Roy.
Okay, maybe we should have
Dr. Roy.
Okay, maybe we should have a history corner. I find history fascinating. I've kind of gone through books, David kind of, you can't really have practical knowledge of history, unfortunately. I know of no way. If anyone has access to a time machine, please let me borrow it. I would love to. I'd go back to good old Mesopotamia and see what Ur and Uruk were like and Gilgamesh and all those beginnings of civilization that I read about.
There are time machines. They date back to about 1850, but they only run one way.
Yeah, that's the problem with time. You can only kind of go one way. You can't. They don't even just give you a ticket for going the wrong way. You just have to go the right way. It's the second law of thermodynamics, basically, that entropy always increases, never decreases in a system.
Yes, but you missed my point. The camera is a one-way time machine. You can go back in time as long as you appreciate the pain of it, which basically started around
1840. Yeah, and I'd love to see those. And as time has gone by, we've been able to tweak those those instruments much nicer. We added color to it, and now we have, I hate to say the word AI. We have AI algorithms that add motion. So, you know, I've seen these weird little promotional products where, you know, you put in pictures of your great-grandparents. Maybe you have a passport picture of them and little else. And the AI will colorize it and make it into a motion picture based upon a two-dimensional photograph. So it's sort of amazing how much more we can get out of AI these days with photography.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
Love the topic. Very interesting stuff. I was dabbling in that world and that era just the other day. And it's worth looking into Zachary Taylor. Nobody's ever heard of Zachary Taylor, but he was around in the very edge of photography. There's photographs of him. And nobody knows who he is, but he's an interesting feller and an interesting demise that people debate about, you know, what was the cause of it. But when you look at it in the prism of history, what followed, you go, that sounds fishy to me. I encourage anybody interested in history to look that one up.
Yeah, Zachary Taylor was our 12th president. Unfortunately, again, history is fascinating, but there's a lot of it, and most people don't know any of it. They know which number president is a present president because they keep on mentioning it. But other than things like that, you know, most people wouldn't recognize about half of the people who were president of the United States before they were born.
Or after.
Well, yeah, in some cases after, but it's a little bit more difficult to not know about Lyndon Johnson if you were born before 1960.
Absolutely, absolutely. I never heard of Zachary Taylor until I thought it. Look at a trend, and I was like, what? That's a crazy trend.
Okay, yeah, I like history. I have nothing against any kind. Unfortunately, there are a lot of civilizations that we just don't have a lot of information about. South America, unfortunately, they didn't keep records. It's interesting, the weird countries that, civilizations that actually we know about solely because they kept records. No one kind of has any knowledge of places like the Hittites. Hittites was a massive, influential country in what's now Turkey, if they hadn't kept ridiculous amounts of records that someone discovered and was able to kind of figure out what happened in ancient times in the Middle East and the area, just because of the Hittites' records, and because of that, people started to wonder who the hell are these Hittites, and so we figured it out to a degree. But if not for their records, all their civilizations were buried under feet and yards of dirt and broken stuff. So, again, history. Read a book. It's good for you.
Read.
Okay, guys. Yes, read. Okay, guys, it's 10:17. It's kind of surprising. We were somehow able to stretch Jim's question in one way or another out to 2 hours. So I want to thank everyone who participated and apologize to those who were getting a little tired of the subject. Thanks to everyone. I enjoyed it. I hope you did, too. You know, like I said, I really was a big fan of Abbott and Costello, who's on first, what's on second, third base. Anyway, Paul, WS2N, is now going to give us the SpaceNet report.
Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome.
AC2GS, WS2N. Good topics tonight. Very good. Time well spent. Anyway, as far as the SpaceNet report, this is Paul, WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And just a few topics. Nothing dramatic going on. in the space world lately. The Starship did fly last Monday, so right, you know, day after the net last week. So that's SpaceX Starship number 11 took off from Boca Chica, Texas. And the goal was to create another suborbital flight with its 400-foot tall rocket with its 33 Raptor engines. And this time they wanted to pretty much duplicate Starship number 10, the one previous. And they did. Number 10 was pretty successful, and then this one also. When I say successful, is they completed the goals that they wanted to. One of the goals was to actually reuse the booster for the Starship. You know, Starship has two components, really, the booster, and then they have the Starship itself. Starship has Raptor engines also, but it only has six of them. It has three regular engines, and they have three of them that are tuned for vacuum use, you know, up in space. And they took off. You know, a couple of minutes later, the booster separated from the Starship, and the booster this time was, they planned on having it come down first into the Gulf of Mexico, which is what they did last time. And it worked out that way. It didn't blow up on the way down like some of the early ones had problems. It continued into space, orbital flight. You know, it got up to speed, got to like around 16.5 1,000 miles an hour instead of the 17,500 that you would need for orbit, just short of that. And the path, in case, you know, in case something went wrong, this thing wouldn't wind up in orbit, and then they would have trouble getting it down, and you'd have this massive piece of steel and equipment floating in orbit. With that, you know, not being able to have it return for who knows how long, and then when it would come back, it would just not want to burn up in the atmosphere because it's designed not to, and it could come crashing down into a city. So the goal is to have a suborbital flight, which it did. They completed a couple of objectives. One is, again, to duplicate what they did with Starship number 10. By releasing, you know, mock satellites, eight of them, I think there were this time eight, and they one would launch one at a time. Again, the satellites themselves will not stay in orbit because they are on a suborbital pad. So these make-believe satellites will eventually, will probably already have. Came back and burnt up in the atmosphere. They needed to test this delivery system that they have to actually have them come out one at a time out of the Starship. Another objective that they met was the relight of an engine. So I waited for this. I watched this thing, and you know, it's only really roughly a 90-minute flight, you know, from Texas to, by the time they wind up in the Indian Ocean near Australia. So I watched the relight of this one engine, and it only lasted like 3 seconds. That's it, not even. But they said that was successful. I thought they were, you know, let it blast away a little bit longer. And the reason they need to be able to do that is when they first do go into orbit, and that won't be for two more flights. The vehicle needs to be able to relight that engine to slow themselves down to deorbit in a proper location. proper location once they do get into orbit will be, again, in the Gulf of Mexico. So we'll see what happens next time. They're going to go to a different version, a little taller rocket next time, and that won't be until most likely January at the earliest for the new version vehicles. And they got to get a move on it because the goal is to have this Starship as the one vehicle that's going to be going back, you know, from the from lunar orbit back down to the surface of the moon and back up again. And actually, in the long run, to have these things reusable. So, you know, we'll see. I'm not going to, you know, stand by and think it's going to happen anytime soon. I think they're many years away from being successful. And my radio here. Okay. Let me just stand by, see if anybody has any comments or questions before we continue. This is WS1.
This is Brian, KF2ZZ. I have a question for you. With the Starship, okay, are they trying to bite off more than they could chew at this point? I mean, when will it be fully ready to go ahead and carry a crew?
A little noisy. You want to know if they are eventually going to be carrying a crew?
Right. I'd like to know when basically they'll be ready to carry a crew into orbit. Is that going to happen anytime soon, or are we talking about like another year of test flights and such?
Another year. Yes. Next flight is going to be, like I said, the newer version. It's supposed to be more powerful. Raptor engines, a little taller vehicle, make probably more fuel. Once they do another suborbital flight with that one, the next one after that is planned to be an orbital flight. And then how many more of them, you know, providing everything goes well, I guess, you know, a couple of flights after that would be the earliest you would be able to put a crew on board. As far as I know, they don't even have one of these, you know, in the interior of one of these things set up for a crew. It looks like the first thing that they're going to be doing is putting these version 3 Starlink satellites into orbit. Now, you know, right now they're doing version 2. And if you see these things, each one gets larger and larger. I mean, version 3 is a very large Starlink satellite. And right now, they are, as fast as they're putting them up, which is, you know, usually around, I want to say 40. 40 satellites. Now, the original ones were 50 at a time, and the other ones are probably around maybe 30 satellites now at a time. I'll have to look that one up. Anyway, as they put them up, and it seems like every week they're putting at least two or three launches up, you know, maybe 50 or, you know, 75 satellites could be in 1 week. But some of them are coming back down. You know, every day they lose at least two satellites. They re-enter the atmosphere. For whatever reason, they either stop working and they have little thrusters on board to slow them down to purposely burn up in the atmosphere. Or the atmosphere expands more than they expected and wind up with more molecules up there to slow them down, and they wind up coming down early. So now this next satellite is going to be larger. It'll be put up by the Starship. And who knows how many they plan on doing that. I mean, he's got thoughts of putting, 20,000 of these things up there. He's already got, I think, close to 9,000 satellites into orbit right now. So I think that's going to be their first goal. So maybe within, I want to say, first crew, maybe, I'm going to guess 2.5 years from now, the earliest back you brought.
Comment.
Go ahead, comment.
It's Brian. One thing I noticed about the Starship, at least at this point, does it have any crew emergency escape system?
Their escape system is come back through the atmosphere and glide down to a landing. A propulsive landing, to come back down. So it's going to be a long time before they can do that. They did perfect this time. When it came through the atmosphere, they're flying in like an S formation instead of just coming, pretty much straight down like the previous ones, and that bleeds off a lot of energy, which is less of a chance of this thing overheating. So yeah, that there is no escape system going uphill, sitting on top of that booster. They're going to have it where, say, something happens to the booster, automatically the engines, all six engines would kick on. By the way, eventually they're going to have 8 engines on the Starship, but all 6 engines would kick on and pull the Starship away from the booster, and then the Starship would then either continue on to orbit or go as planned, as a deorbit and come back and land back in Boca Chica, Texas. By the way, eventually they plan on flying these things eventually out of Florida as well. Not like all the old systems. The launch abort systems, like they had on Mercury, the top of the vehicle, a solid engine would fire and pull the Mercury spacecraft away from the Agena rocket or the earlier flight, the Redstone rocket. But then Mercury was only one person in the vehicle. Then they had Gemini, that was two. Gemini did not have that escape system. So their theory was similar, actually, to what Starship has. If something happens, they would just light the engines and separate from the booster. That wasn't good enough for Apollo, though. Apollo went back to the launch abort system, similar to Mercury, and these large solid engines on top, and that would pull the spacecraft away from the upper stage, and then you get to the shuttle system. Again, no way of aborting there. So what they would do is, hope nothing blew up, and then eventually separate from the external tank. If there was a problem, the shuttle would, automatically come back and land in different locations around the globe. They had different abort landing places they could go to, instead of just Vandenberg or California, which they used to land in, or New Mexico, White Sands, New Mexico, and then, of course, Florida, they used to land in. But, yeah, That was their abort system. And of course, that didn't work for Challenger. You know, they were going uphill, and the O-ring burnt out, and burnt into the external tank, and that thing blew up. So, you know, there was no way they can get away from it. And, you know, it's a dangerous situation. Now, what I like on the new one, the space launch system, since you brought up the launch abort system, they have, a very large, solid booster rockets on top. It's the 40s exhaust nozzles sticking out of the top. You know, if those things go off, that's going to pull the whole spacecraft away from the upper stage. And it's an elaborate system, the launch abort system. They have three different sets of ways that thing's going to fire. One is what I just said. They have the massive rocket would pull this whole, you know, 30,000 pound spacecraft away from the vehicle. And also attached to the abort system is they have this jettison of rockets. So let's say everything goes fine, just the jettison rockets go off. Now that pulls the covers off. They call them ogive covers away from the vehicle. And that exposes the front of the vehicle to space. That's the way it's supposed to work. And then on the very top of the launch and board system, they have eight of these little tiny openings. And depending on, you know, which ones are being used, it could push the rocket either left, right, or you know, one way or the other. And this way, if it did pull the spacecraft away, these things would fire and reorient the spacecraft to the direction that they would need it to be, which is blunt end down. This way, that's the way they always come through the atmosphere, blunt end down, not nose first. So it's an elaborate launch abort system. Anyway, good question. Back to you, Brian.
No, very interesting. Very interesting. How is Boeing coming along with their, their capsule? Did they launch another one with, astronauts in it to go to the ISS, or they did not yet since the last one?
Yeah, the last one was the one that took up the two astronauts, Sonny Williams and Butch. That was the last one launched with a crew. That's a Starliner. And, of course, it worked. It got them there. But then they thought, well, maybe the thruster problem might give them problems on the way back. And they decided to stay up there almost a year, waiting for the right opportunity to come back down. Eventually, they went down on a Dragon spacecraft. But the Starliner itself came back on its own. If they put the crew in there, they would have made it. But they did successfully bring it through the atmosphere and landed exactly where it's supposed to, on solid ground in White Sands, New Mexico. And that vehicle could be repurposed and eventually flown again, which the present plan is by Boeing to actually eventually do that. I don't know with the finances, the way things are going with this administration, who knows. But last I heard, they plan on eventually launching another one, this time uncrewed, duplicating a previous launch before the crew went up. Send it up, make sure all the thrusters work the way it's supposed to, dock with the ISS, and load some supplies and all, like they did last time. And then it would come back down, land in
White Sands in Mexico. The fight after that, they again would send a crew up. Hopefully that will happen in the future, but I don't know. I just don't know anymore. It's very hard to get these information. I go to the NASA website, and I don't know, they're very vague in what they're talking about when I do read different stories from them. Back to you, Brian.
I think you brought me up to date. Thank you very, very much. One other thing. When the Starship lands, I see it going down into the water. Isn't it supposed to land on a platform?
No platform. Not like the Falcon 9 does. You know, they land on the drone ships, big gigantic cargo vehicles that are out there. They own three of them now. One stationed out in Vandenberg, California, to catch the boosters when they come down land. And there's two on the East Coast for Florida. They're a little bit busier on the East Coast. And, Starship is different. Starship, they have this system where the booster itself has successfully been caught three times by the launch tower where it launched from. You know, it comes back down through the atmosphere, and after a couple of minutes of flight, you know, I think 2.5 to 3 minutes of flight, it starts to come back down. Engines light to slow itself down and guide itself down to where it launched from the same launch complex. They have these big arms that come out and grab it as it's coming down slowly vertically. And they have done that successfully three times without failure. The ones that you're seeing come down vertically and land in the Gulf of Mexico, that's because they're testing other things, and they don't have a plan of, you know, they plan on letting them go into the drink. And, you know, they're testing other maneuvers and things like that, and that's planned on doing that. But the goal is to catch them all, you know, go up, come down, and come back and catch them on, you know, where they launched from. The Starship itself, then, of course, would, you know, go into orbit, do its mission, and whether it has a crew on it or not, come through the atmosphere, come back to Boca Chica, Texas, come back vertically, and they're going to have another launch tower that Starship could be caught by. So that would be the ideal situation. And then they would both be 100% reusable, you know, just, you know, theoretically. It's not going to happen, but theoretically, refuel it, refuel both of them, put them both back together again on a launch band, and launch them again. I mean, that's Elon Musk's dream. Back to you, Brian.
I understand now. When it splashes down to the ocean, do they retrieve the whole thing?
No, that's how. To me, it's nothing but pollution, but, you know, I mean, we've been doing that. All the countries have been doing that for decades, you know, with these boosters. You know, I mean, Mercury did it, Gemini did it, Apollo did it, the missions to the Skylab, all these flights. All the ones to the moon, all those boosters, all go into the ocean, including, you know, some of the ones we're talking about now with Starship, you know. Hopefully they get their act together someday, and they won't be, you know, they won't need to test anymore and have it go into the water. But, you know, they'll all be coming back to land
and yet there's no drone ship planned for that. The heavy lift vehicle that, you know, one of the competitors by Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos, he's got a ship that's built already, and hopefully we'll see that happen, I guess, by the end of the year, maybe. They plan on doing at least one more launch with the New Glenn. And that's a heavy lift vehicle, you know. Not as big as Starship, but it's up there pretty good. And that would land on a drone ship and float back to, the Cape, and they would reuse that one. Another company doing that will be Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is going to have its own drone ship out there, and they'll be launching the Neutron rocket from Virginia, and that will have the booster return and land on a drone ship there, and then brought back to Wallops Island in Virginia and refueled and ready to go. I don't think it's ever going to get as fast as an airplane, but I mean, that's all of these people's dreams. Back to you, Brian. WS2N.
Oh, thanks, Paul. I was just, like, wondering, you know, why they don't go ahead and retrieve all these things that, these stages that have fallen from space. I mean, it's something that could be good for the environment by retrieving all these things and recycling them.
Yeah, it's too expensive to try to, you know, fish them out of the water. So what they do is you see them land. Okay, it's successful. Second light, you know, they light off they call them FTS, the flight termination system. The FTS ignites, and the whole thing blows up, and whatever fuel is left also gets blown up. And then all the pieces just, you know, sink to the bottom, you know, down to the bottom of the ocean, or the Gulf of Mexico. Or the Starship is also coming down vertically when it comes down in the Indian Ocean. They have a buoy out there. They know exactly what's going to come back down. So they film it. You see pictures of this thing. Starship coming down vertically. Into the water, you know, in the Indian Ocean, just off the coast of Australia. And, they think nothing of it, right to the bottom of the sea. You know, they always said Wernher von Braun would have, you know, freaked out if he was still around today. But, you know, seeing that not only our country, all these other countries are still polluting the oceans. He always thought that someday all these rockets would be reusable. Well, SpaceX is, you know, still pretty good. I mean, they're very good at catching hundreds of these Falcon 9 rockets that they've sent up. And the other companies, like I said, Rocket Lab with the Neutron rocket, they'll be following soon. Along with New Glenn, New Glenn with Blue Origin. Back to you.
I kind of like the idea that it's reusable. The way they're doing it SpaceX with those things called chopsticks, where it catches the Starship. At least they're trying to go ahead and get it back. It surprises me that they didn't have any system or any flotation system to retrieve the stage when it came back into the water for further analysis. So, I don't know. Maybe half-baked.
Yeah, well, the vehicle, the booster, is what, 250 feet tall, something like that, close to it, and extremely wide, I think 27 feet wide or something, compared to the 12-foot diameter of a Falcon 9, and maybe one-third of the height. So those things are landing on a ship that's maybe the size of a football field. So how big of a ship would you need to scale it up to catch one of these boosters coming down? And on top of that, then you would also have to have legs. Falcon 9 has three big legs that come out to land on. You'd have to design the Starship with legs. It's not designed with legs. They thought about it in the beginning, but in rocketry, everything is weight, and if they could do away with it, all the mechanisms and everything that's involved with these big legs, it's a plus for the company. So he got the bright idea to catch the boosters with the chopsticks, and I would think that somewhere down the line he would have to put legs on this, because he's got ambition of using this thing someday in the future to launch suborbitally, bring material and supplies, let's say for the military, from here to, some war-torn country in the middle of nowhere somewhere. So, if he planned on doing that, he'd have to have this thing have legs to come down and land. The Starship part anyway, not the booster. The one that's going to be landing on the moon, that's being designed with legs, the Starship, because they need that. There's not going to be a launch tower waiting to catch the Starship as it enters the area near the surface of the moon. So that's an interesting problem, the Starship, as well. That's what I'm saying. There's a lot of things that have to happen here before we can get a crew eventually back to the moon, that's for sure. Anything else, Brian?
No, that's about it. Also, the moon is one-sixth of Earth's gravity, so it won't need as heavy mechanism to land, to bear all that weight, so that'll be another advantage. I just would like to see the company go ahead and take some of this stuff and make it retrievable for analysis and reuse rather than polluting the oceans even more than they are. But thank you very much for the explanation and the details. Always appreciate it. And, of course, what you and Roy do are highly, highly appreciated. And I don't think I have any further questions.
Okay, and a good point about the 1/6 gravity, yeah. And then think of that, you won't need to have your legs beefed up like you would need on Earth. But, I've seen drawings of what this is going to look like. He's going to use six legs. So, we'll see. I'm still in doubt of, who's going to really be able to land people on the moon first, Starship or the crew vehicle being made by Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' group. He's got a contract with NASA, too, to do the same thing, to take people down to the moon and then back up. And I like Bezos' idea. It looks like a LEM, the ones that we use for Apollo. It looks like a LEM on steroids, maybe like three times the size of it, huge, huge vehicle. But same idea, where you would, come down, land with a descent module,
and then the ascent module. I heard two versions. It looks like they're going to do away with the ascent module system, that the descent module is going to realign and take the whole thing back up to lunar orbit. With LEM, what they did is they used the descent module, came down, landed, and then they had the ascent module on top, and that would ignite and use the descent module as a launch platform, which I thought was a great, great design. So who knows what they're going to do with that in the future. Who's going to win? I don't know. I'm putting my money on Jeff Bezos, though. This other system is way too complicated. Anyway, I wanted to mention, I think, tomorrow night. Let's see what day. Probably Tuesday night. There's a launch from Japan. And it's their heavy lift vehicle, which is liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. It's their next version of they call it the H2 vehicle. It was the H2A vehicle, the H2B vehicle. Both liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rockets that Japan's been using a couple of decades now. And they now make the H3, which is going to replace both the H2A and the H2B version. H2B version was only used for resupplying the International Space Station with the HTV vehicle. And that made 9 different flights to the space station, roughly one a year. But that stopped quite a few years ago because they redesigned the HTV cargo vehicle, much bigger vehicle, carrying, you know, maybe 25% more mass, more volume, and eventually be capable of actually flying to the moon to resupply a space station going around the moon. Hopefully they do that in the future. And this is going to be the first flight of this new cargo vehicle by Japan. And it should take off, I guess, in 2 days on their new version of the H3, that now it's called the H3 rocket. They've launched that thing about, I think, maybe 4 times or so. It's already become reliable. So that probably won't be a problem. But, I'll be following that mission starting on Tuesday. See if they get off the pad. And I'd like to see if HTV, actually, they're calling the HTV-X now, makes it to the International Space Station for resupplying it. So, it's an international space station, so you have different countries involved, and this is one way that Japan has contributed to the International Space Station. And, through that, of course, they've had many astronauts from Japan fly up to the space station. Spend plenty of time up there. In fact, there's one guy up there now. So any comments before we close down? I'm getting to, it's almost 11 o'clock. This is WS2N.
No, the only thing I could say is JAXA has an interesting website. That's the Japanese Space Agency. But with all of this, whichever way you slice it and dice it, there has to be something better than chemical rockets or something else that has a tremendous amount of energy and less amount of weight in space. Otherwise, it's all variations on a theme, But thank you very much for everything. Much appreciated, Paul. And I'll stand by.
Yeah, I like the ion engines. They've been using them for a couple of maybe 20 years now. And they're very good. you know, they can't get you off the surface of the earth. They're not powerful enough to do that, but and they won't work, you know, with, if they're in an atmosphere, they need to be in a vacuum to work. But they're great, you know. You know, you get a chemical rocket, get you off the earth, put you into orbit, maybe into a TLI, translunar injection, into, you know, heading to the moon or to Mars. And then after that, you light off these ion engines. Now, without a crew, because these things are they're going to take a long time to get up to the speed. But once they do, you know, those things really haul, you know. And they don't shut off for not weeks, months, sometimes years. They can use these ion engines. And even so, the thrust from it maybe is, you know, it's equivalent to, you know, holding maybe five pieces of paper in your hand at the most. But, you know, that thrust constantly going like that, you know, year in, year out, you know, you can get up to a pretty good velocity. And I'm a big fan of the ion engines. So, okay. Thanks for all of that. For now, I'm going to turn it back to Roy. Tomorrow night is Monday night, so the club always has the club info net on these repeaters. And you don't have to remember to check in. They're happy to hear from everybody. And then that's always followed by Swap and Shop, and that's followed by Radio Newsline. And that's pretty much it for me. Roy, back to you. AC2GS, WS2N for the Space Net Report. For the TechNet, back to you, Roy.
Yeah, this is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the Space Net Report. Thank you for all that you do for the Technical Net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. It was an interesting experience, hopefully not a standard operating one. We hopefully won't be quite banging and kicking and dragging that poor horse much anymore. But we'll see what happens. We'll play it by ear. Thanks to everyone. Stay safe. Be well. Come back next Sunday if you can, because we're going to try and do this all over again. As always, I like to remind people of some clever comments from some clever people. Our own K2RW always would end his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other. And good old Epictetus, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. You keep your mind open to new ideas, but not so wide open that your brain falls out, because you don't want your brain to fall out and get dirty and such. Anyway, everyone, stay safe, be well, come back next week. And this is AC2GS formally closing this particular episode of the Limewire Technical Net after I say, Slava Yonit.
Very good, Roy. Thank you so much for what you do, and Paul the same. And that's about it. Have a very good evening. This is KFQZZ clearing the frequency. Good night.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2